You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Morris Dickstein, a literary critic, cultural historian, and City University of New York professor, died on March 23, 2021, at his home in Manhattan. He was 81. He was a great writer and the author of many important works, including Gates of Eden, American Culture in the 60s, published in 1977. His book, Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression, published in 2009, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. When that book was published, I was lucky enough to have a great conversation with him for this program, and I want to share it with you this week. I began our interview by asking Professor Dickstein about the word depression. His book stated that the word had never been used to describe an economic situation before 1929.
Well, I'm not sure it had never been used, but it was the typical phrase in the 19th century was a panic, the panic of 1873, the panic of 1893-94. And I think Herbert Hoover and his media supporters felt that depression would be a less depressing term. I don't know why.
Because it seems like a very depressing term.
Well, panic, though, you know,
that's scary.
Suggests let's run to the exits, right?
Right, right. Well, before we get started in the 1930s, I want to ask you another sort of defining question. You also have written a book about American culture in the 60s.
And right.
So how do you define culture?
Well, what I do is, of course, I say in the introduction to that book that, of course, we think of culture in two ways. In one sense, it's culture meaning the entire tissue of society. In another sense, of course, we mean it in terms of the arts, in terms of books and music and the visual arts and so on. And what I like to do is to try to use the latter, try to use the arts as a way of gaining access to, you know, what was happening in the larger society. If I had had a bit more courage, I would have called this the inner history of the Depression, because I do feel that the arts gives you access to, you might say, the psyche of a period, or certainly the feelings of a period. Not all of those feelings, and not every work of art is entirely a reliable indicator, but when you put a lot of them together, I think you get a good sense of the inner life of any period.
We love to sort of put everything into decades, you know, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and 50s. But yet it does sort of seem to work. I mean, there's a certain identification with 1930s culture that's different for them, certainly from the 20s and 40s.
Right. Well, it's convenient in the sense that, you know, no one could deny that the Depression, which started at the end of 1929 and more or less ended in 1941, roughly coincided with the calendar decade. It's a little more dicey with the 60s, in that some people feel that the 60s really began with the Kennedy assassination and didn't end till Watergate, but there's also a case to be made that the 60s started in 1959 or 1960 and finally exploded just around 1970. So, you know, I would never say that about other decades. I don't feel that the 70s was a really coherent period. But certainly the 30s and the 60s were.
Now, the popular culture it kind of reached its early peak in the 1930s. I mean, mass communication, then radio, movies really came into their own in that decade, would you say?
Well, there was a real technological leap forward. And so that, you know, popular culture had not previously been anything you would call mass culture. Popular culture had largely involved local traditions and folk traditions, and it was different in different parts of the country. But the new technology of radio, and especially of talking pictures, and to some extent of recorded music, created a national culture pretty much for the first time, and this coincided with the terrible economic calamity of the Depression. And so this got, you know, blared to the whole country and began to be used by the administration, by FDR, as a way of both alerting people to what was happening, at the same time trying to gain support for the various New Deal programs, which were radically different from anything the federal government had ever done before.
Popular culture also embraced the administration in a way that I think it never did before or since. I mean, I'm thinking of the scene in Footlight Parade where they suddenly hold up a picture of Franklin Roosevelt with a big salute.
Well, part of that is that Footlight Parade was made at Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers, Jack Warner was a friend of FDR, and so the Warner Brothers films, which had been very downbeat just a year earlier, think of the downbeat ending of a movie like I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang. But as soon as Roosevelt took over, and even before that, after he was elected, Warner Brothers films about the Depression, and they were the main studio trying to deal directly with the Depression, took a much more upbeat turn, and you see the blue eagle of the NRA in the background of some scenes, and FDR is very much a presence in some of those movies, certainly in the background.
Would you say that Warner Brothers was more supportive than MGM? Or?
Well, it was certainly more supportive in the sense that, first of all, it publicized the Depression, which helped, you know, bring support for crisis programs. MGM, run by Louis Mayer was one of the few Rock Rib Republicans running a studio. This came out a year later when he led the fight to keep Upton Sinclair from being elected governor of California,
right?
And did using some very dirty tactics. So I think there was quite a difference between the political mood at MGM and the political mood at Warner Brothers.
And of course, I guess there's a big difference between the political mood in Los Angeles and the one in New York or in Washington. I mean, the LA Times was a very different paper than the New York Times, yeah?
Very different from what it is today, yes. Well, the New York Times was pretty conservative then. I think both families running both papers were relatively conservative. Chandler, of course, family much more conservative. But it was also a general phenomenon that the media tried very hard not to publicize the Depression, not to alarm people. There was a famous story late in 1932 in Fortune magazine, and which was called No One Has Starved, as if that were a great achievement, that, yes, we have all these problems, but no one has starved. And, you know, this really acknowledged the Depression in a way that mainstream media had hesitated to do until that point.
We're talking with Morris Dickstein, and his new book is called Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. Well, the 1930s was a decade in which the motion picture industry in America really flourished and began its sort of domination of the world. And so many of the great genres were born in that era, and some are very specific to that time and didn't last, like, for instance, the screwball comedy, which you spent some time with in Dancing in the Dark. Why was the Depression the right time for Bringing Up Baby and My Man Godfrey and The Awful Truth?
Well, the one reason was simply that the film culture of the 30s in Hollywood divided very sharply in the middle of the 1930s. The so-called pre-code period of 1930 to 1934, before the production code, and the Hays office really enforced it very, very strongly, was a rather wild, anarchic period in which you could some very explicit sexual and amoral doings were portrayed, as well as some, you know, wild political doings. After 1934, the lords of the censorship, the guardians of morality, really cracked down, and they had to find a way of doing romance that was more oblique and that involved very little explicit sexuality, though I think there's a great deal of eroticism in those movies, even though it's all indirect. So I think that was one reason. Another reason, of course, was that people wanted and needed it in the same way that the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers films were hugely popular. I see those films as a kind of dialogue with the Depression, attempting to lift people's spirits and to give them a kind of charge of excitement and energy that the Depression had sort of flattened out of people's individual lives as well as the culture in general. And, you know, some of them do deal with the Depression explicitly, like My Man Godfrey. Others, you wouldn't know there was a Depression, such as, you know, Bringing Up Baby. But even the ones that don't acknowledge the Depression are done with such zip, such speed, such sharpness that they're like an adrenaline shot into the culture, and it's just what people felt they needed in their lives.
Well, let's talk about those Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers pictures for a minute. They almost prefigure the situation comedy in that almost all of them have an identical plot, don't they?
Yeah, the plot, which more or less got established very early on, was that, you know, we know, the audience knows that Fred and Ginger are made for each other, but they don't know it, and they contrive every possible disagreement and misunderstanding, especially when they encounter each other and they're just talking to each other. And then somehow magically, when they sing, or especially when they dance, they achieve just this very sublime harmony of movement and flow. And that flow, I relate to that charge of energy that you get, you know, in the screwball comedies. But the togetherness that they achieve in dance, I think, can very easily be related to a similar message that you get in a film like The Grapes of Wrath, which, or even the original novel, which basically says, you know, we're under stress. Separately we fail, but together, you know, together we may have a chance. Together we may achieve something. Now, the romantic version of it with Astaire and Rogers is a little different from the, you might call, the social communal version of it in something like The Grapes of Wrath. But I think this was one of the few periods when the idea of the group, of the collective, took precedence over American individualism. Of course, there had been romance in American culture for a long time, but never with quite the cultural bearing that it gets in the screwball comedies or in the Astaire Rogers films.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. This week, From the Bookshelf remembers the late Morris Dickstein as we listen back to our 2009 conversation about his book, Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. I asked how people searching for a political solution to the Depression experimented with a variety of political ideas which would later be used against them in the post-war McCarthy-era witch hunts.
Well, there was a push towards collectivism, not the radical collectivism that you get, you know, the abroad in countries which lean towards fascism, like Germany and Italy, or towards militarism, like Japan, or towards communism, like the Soviet Union. There were some Americans, quite a few Americans, who sympathized with those movements. But by and large, you know, the collective pressures that you get in American culture were channeled by the New Deal into, a kind of a democratic pattern which simply involved social programs that the federal government had never done before. And, this particular American form of collectivism was articulated by Roosevelt in a number of speeches and fireside chats, but particularly in his second inaugural address of 1937, where he says, individually, personally, we lead individual lives, but in terms of the well-being of our society, we have to think collectively. We have to think in terms of mutual benefit and not simply of individual gains and goals.
And did he use the word collective?
Well, I don't remember. I think whether he used community or solidarity, he probably did not use the word collective, but this was certainly the thrust of it.
And I guess there's a certain democracy in Fred Astaire and in Bing Crosby also, in that although both men were extremely talented with loads and loads of technique, part of their technique was the ease in which they segued from normal speech and activity into singing or dancing, giving the illusion that everybody could do it.
Yeah, there was first of all, their own backgrounds had been all very modest, even though they came to represent something, you know, swanky or elegant or just very much at ease. And I think that the humble background, especially of Astaire and Cary Grant, you know, contributed to a kind of everyman quality, even in their performances, upper-class swells. And it became something that people were able to identify with. it became a very strong vicarious point of identification, to the extent that the studio that made the Astaire Rogers films, and essentially was floated by the success of those films, RKO, panicked occasionally that could there yet be another movie in which the American people would actually buy tickets to go see the rich at play. So they made a movie like Follow the Fleet, in which Astaire plays someone who quits show business to join the Navy because Ginger won't have him. And, you know, they thought that people would identify more with the ordinary guy persona. It turns out, of course, that in the Navy, aboard ship, they put on a show in which you get the traditional Astaire in top hat, tie, and tail. So they were trying to play both sides of the street.
And it's also amazing that those particular films, I think most listeners might be surprised to learn that Fred Astaire introduced more popular standards than any other performer.
Well, he's a very underrated as a singer, but composers really admired his work. Gershwin not so much, but a lot of other composers really admired his work because, you know, all the really great singers of the 30s, Crosby, Ethel Merman, Astaire, a number of others, Ella Fitzgerald, who was emerging toward the end of the period, were extraordinarily respectful of the songs, and particularly about articulating the words of the songs and using the whole song, including the introductory verse, which kind of sets the dramatic picture for the song. And that, I think, Sinatra later followed that tradition very strongly. Each of them did, you know, an interpretation of these standards, but at the same time, the faithfulness to the original words and melody was something that composers loved, and that really makes them much more effective today than much more stylized versions of the standards.
We're talking with Morris Dickstein, and his latest book is called Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. You mentioned The Grapes of Wrath. What else were people reading in the Depression?
Well, they were reading a lot of historical novels like Gone with the Wind or Anthony Adverse. At the end of the period, surprisingly, they were reading people like Richard Wright. It was a Book of the Month Club selection in 1940, a very shocking book about race relations in America. Some of the books that I deal with in my book were books that were not fully appreciated at the time for various reasons. Sometimes they were ahead of their time, like the novels of Nathaniel West. At other times, they had bad luck with the bankruptcy of their publishers, even though they had been well received, like Henry Roth's Call of Sleep. I believe that these books, because in many cases they're more complex and richer, give us just as much or more insight into the mind of the Depression as books that were wildly popular.
Did people read in general more then than they do now, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure what the figures would be. I'm sure they read more because they didn't have all the electronic distractions that we have today. They had the movies and they had the radio. And then they had reading, and they had various other fads like, you know, miniature golf and crossword puzzles and so on. Mm-hmm. They read a lot of mysteries. It was a great period, for example, for the hard-boiled mystery story, you know.
Dashiell
Hammett and Raymond Chandler toward the end of the decade and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
those two writers, for instance, both of them considered their work to be disposable, that they were writing it for the pulp, and that it wouldn't last. I think they would both be surprised that their work is lasting.
I'm not sure that they weren't sneakingly trying to write works of art. maybe in their stories for the pulp magazines, less so. But in their novels, I think that they made a real effort. I mean, the odd thing was that these books were ready-made for the movies, but the films that were made of them, relatively few films that were made from them in the 30s, were not particularly good. And it was only in the 40s and early 50s that the really good adaptations of the 30s hard-boiled novels came about. I mean, this led to a very odd paradox, which was, you know, that during the period of the worst economic crisis, a lot of the culture was very lively, was very optimistic, was very fizzy and effervescent in the 30s. And during the period of the 40s, after the war, when the U.S. economy took its greatest liftoff into prosperity more than any time before or since, these film noir, these dark movies, many of them adapted from the novels of the 30s, you know, became a kind of dark undercurrent within a mostly optimistic culture. It's interesting, kind of dialectic within the culture itself between optimism and pessimism.
Do you think that's due to the, you know, in the post-war era, the fact that although things were booming, we now know that there were Nazis and the things that people are capable of, and we'd seen films of the concentration camps? And
I think some of it had to do with, you know, revelations about the camps and the Holocaust, and some of it had to do with the fact that, you know, there was the potential for nuclear war was, you know, lurking in the background and created a sense of menace that is reflected in, like, the sci-fi films of the 1950s. A lot of people, you know, dubbed the 40s and 50s the age of anxiety, even though the above-ground culture really makes it seem like an age of, you know, suburban optimism. I think there are many different threads in any cultural period, and as there are in the 1930s.
Well, the gangster pictures were big in the 1930s, but they kind of go through a sort of a metamorphosis. I mean, the beginning gangster pictures like Little Caesar and Public Enemy, I guess because they're pre-code, are violent and sad. And then they kind of become more like Dead End Kid kind of
movie. Yeah, right. Well, they're much more heroic in the early 30s in the classic gangster films. I mean, they create figures that were, you know, like the figures in screwball comedy were electric with energy, Cagney in the Public Enemy, for example, or Edward G. Robinson. And they were also the last readout of, you might say, individualism in the 30s, something that people long for in the sense that the Cagney, you know, starts in the gutter and rises to the top of the world, you know, and ends up in the gutter. And, you know, the gangsters seemed in the early 30s to be the only really successful businessmen. And so to some extent, they represented a residue of an older individualist culture in America that people had some nostalgia for. In another respect, of course, they represented a kind of can-do attitude that people, felt identified with, even though they were wary of their ruthlessness and amorality.
What are your thoughts about Walt Disney and the rise of the animated cartoon during that period?
Well, you know, there was a love of the anti-hero in the 1930s, of the outlaw figure. There were many stories based on Bonnie and Clyde, for example. And I think we tend to forget that the early versions of Mickey Mouse, very much like the early incarnations of Chaplin's tramp figure, he was quite a bit of a scamp. He was a troublemaker, difficult, a trickster figure. It took a while for Mickey Mouse, for example, to become the lovable figure that he later became, and similarly for Chaplin. And I think that people's initial identification, and intellectuals, for example, loved the early Mickey Mouse. But I think that people identified with him as a kind of scamp.
What about, who were the visual artists that you think dominated the period?
Some of them really carried over from an earlier era. I think one of the great painters of the 30s, but as it also had been in the 20s and the 40s and the 50s, was Edward Hopper, one of the great and haunting American realists. There were a lot of artists who, you know, bought into social consciousness. Some of them were supported by the government. A lot of artists, dug deeply into American traditions. Artists who later became famous as abstract expressionists, like Pollock, were working in a different vein in the 1930s. Probably one of the great great artists of the 30s was Pollock's teacher, Thomas Hart Benton. And his murals and paintings from the 30s are probably had the greatest influence on other muralists, and they really represent epic versions of the world of the 30s as he saw it then and as we still see it today.
Do you think that today popular culture is so pervasive and there's so much of it that it would be impossible for a period to be so identified by its culture as the 30s or the 60s?
Well, in the same way that the 30s, I think, created a national culture, I think we have decreated the national culture. We have returned all our various electronic means and the Internet and so on and everything from Walkman on to various kinds of personal computers have recreated the kind of niche culture that existed before the national culture of the 30s, so that the period from the 30s through the 50s and 60s is not only the period of the classic Hollywood cinema, but it's the classic moment of the pervasive national culture in which everybody was going to the same movie in the same week and so on. This is certainly no longer true today. I mean, it's now taster's choice. So you watch your DVD or whatever whenever you want to. And
I mean, even on September 11th, I think it was possible for a lot of young people. I mean, when I was a little kid, I remember when President Kennedy was assassinated because there was no getting away from it. I had to remember it. But I think young people today who were alive on September 11th could easily not be aware of it because they were watching the Cartoon Network or something at that time.
Well, I do think that, you know, that this pervasive national culture revives it. Either catastrophic moments or moments of national celebration. I'm sure a lot of people saw at least part of, you know, Obama's inauguration. A lot of people saw some of the Teddy Kennedy funeral and so on. I think one thing that you do have that is pervasive is, you know, the 24-hour news cycle on the cable networks.
Yeah.
And that saturates you with something that's happening much more than you want to be saturated, because sometimes nothing is happening.
And that's the worst time, because when nothing is happening, then they make...
And they still have to keep talking.
They make something out of nothing. Well, Morris Dickstein is my guest, and his book is called Dancing in the Dark, A Cultural History of the Great Depression. It's a marvelous book, and we've just sort of scratched the surface of it. And thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Morris Dickstein from 2009. He died last month at the age of 81 from Parkinson's disease. He was also the author of Leopards in the Temple, The Transformation of American Fiction, 1945 to 1970, A Mirror in the Roadway, Literature in the Real World, and in 2015, a memoir, Why Not Say What Happened? A Sentimental Education. When we return, From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren joins us to talk about some new publications we should be reading. Stay with us. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren joins us now. She's the author of The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat, which is a wonderful book and you should read it. And Lissa Warren has been an insider in the publishing world as a book publicist for many years and has brought us some of our best guests on From the Bookshelf. She always has a lot of interesting new books to talk about, so let's get to it. Lissa Warren, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Gary. Good to be here.
What's new?
I got my vaccine scheduled.
Yay!
I'm super excited about it. I was in the last group because I am so young and so healthy.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a downside to being young and healthy. But now I'm good. April 22nd, get my first shot.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm relieved.
Yes, I have mine. And I hope everybody listening gets theirs.
Me too. Mm. For all of their sakes.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, how's your mom? Is she good?
She's good. And she got her second shot. And it's been 14 days later. So she is in the clear, Gary. Thank you for asking about her. I mean, you know, she's still going to be careful. But
yeah, yes, we all have to be careful.
Yes.
Lissa and I are wearing masks right now, even though we're talking on Zoom. Lissa, tell us about some books that you've been reading.
Well, first of all, I have Beneficence by Meredith Hall. It's published by David R. Godin Publisher, a wonderful literary press here in the Boston area where I am based.
So, Meredith Hall, where do I know her name?
You might know it from her last book. It's a memoir called Without a Map. It was published by Beacon Press, and it was a New York Times bestseller. But this book, Beneficence, it's her debut novel, and she wrote it at the age of 70, which I think is pretty darn cool. Yeah. It's set on a dairy farm in Maine, starting in 1947 and concluding in 1965.
So it's like an epic. What's it about?
About a very close family of five, the Centers, who own and run the farm. And it's told in alternating voices, that of the mother, Doris, the father, Tup, and their middle child, the only girl, Dodie. And the book is structured in four sections: before, during, after, and here. And in that second section, a tragedy occurs, something unimaginable, and yet when you read it, it's somehow almost inevitable. And the rest of the book is them trying to make sense of what happened and forgive each other and forgive themselves, and none of it comes easy. It's one of those books that breaks and then reassembles you, and I just can't say enough good things about it.
And the writer?
Oh, it's perfect. She is a master. Can I read you a little bit of it? Would that be okay?
I'd love it.
All right. This is Doris describing motherhood. We can't ever know what will come. You meet a man and marry him and find out whether you made a good choice or not. If you did, you love each other and work hard. And then you have your first baby, and whatever it is that you dreamed about changes the first time you hold him and feed him and watch him study your face. Sonny came when I was 19 years old, and I forgot forever any of those things I had ever thought I wanted. I felt as if I were God, making such a good world for our children.
That's beautiful. Can you read me the whole book now?
I would gladly do it, but I don't think I could do it justice. It is so well written. So good.
Wow, that sounds good. What else have you got?
I have Escape from Castro's Cuba. Now, this is also a novel. This is by Tim Wendell, and it's published by the University of Nebraska Press.
Tim Wendell, the baseball journalist.
Yeah, that's the guy. He was a founding editor of USA Today's Baseball Weekly, and he wrote a bunch of nonfiction books about baseball. But this book is a novel.
And he's written a previous novel, right?
Yeah, this is a sequel. It's a sequel to his critically acclaimed Castro's Curveball. And in it, a former Washington Senators minor league catcher named Billy Bryan has returned to Havana with a small role in a movie that's being filmed on location. He soon realizes that this place and this past of his, it has remained as star-crossed as when he played winter ball in the Cuban capital decades earlier. And then against his better judgment, Billy becomes entangled in a scheme to sort of spirit away a top baseball prospect, like right off the island. This pits him against his old friend, Fidel Castro, and despite being in his final days, the dictator remains a dangerous, dangerous adversary, as does the Cuban sports machine and the Mexican crime syndicates that now direct baseball talent toward the U.S. major leagues.
So it's a novel, but there's a lot of stuff about the real Cuba that we learn?
Yeah, we learn a lot about today in Cuba, and we learn that, you know, it's not easy for Cuban baseball players under Fidel Castro's regime. It never was. And then the implosion of the Soviet Union, that changed things even more. And we don't just learn about Cuban sports because, you know, I'm not that much of a sports buff. The book wouldn't have resonated with me as much as it did if it was all about sports. We learn about Cuban culture. And we learn how African and Spanish and Anglo cultures converged and how they often clash in Cuba, too. You can even see it in Havana's architecture when you walk along the streets. It's a beautiful book. It transports you to Cuba. It really does.
Well, you know, baseball is really great. I don't know if you know this or not, but you have a baseball team there in Boston. You could go and win this season if they allow people to go. You could go.
Can I confess something to you, but you can't repeat it to anyone?
Yeah, no one listens to the show.
I'm actually a Yankees fan.
Well, that's okay. They're going to come and get you.
Probably.
What's next?
No Bad Deed. This is another novel. It's by Heather Chavez. It's published by William Morrow, which is a division of HarperCollins.
It's a thriller?
Yes, it's the page turner of the three novels that I've talked with you about.
The protagonist is, I think I read about this, a veterinarian. Is that right?
That's correct. Her name is Cassie Larkin. She's a veterinarian and a mom of two. She intervenes when a stranger is being assaulted by the side of a road on a rainy night. And then the next day, her husband disappears, and she's left to determine if there's a connection between the two events. And of course, there is a connection between them. The rest of the book is full of good people doing bad things and vice versa. Lies being told and secrets being revealed. Throw in a couple of child abductions, a teacher's alleged affair with a student, and a woman being buried alive only to claw her way out of her own grave, and you'll have a sense of the twists and turns that this book takes.
And this is Feva's first book?
This is her first book indeed, and she got it published by one of the country's biggest publishers at the age of 50, no less, which I think is pretty impressive. And did I mention that the book takes place in Sonoma County?
No, that's close by.
Not too far away at all.
Is it very violent, this book?
Not unsettlingly so, but you know, bad things do happen. They're just not gross. It's not gross.
A lot of thrillers, I think, are overly violent, and I think people read them at bedtime, and then
yeah, and it gets your adrenaline pumping, and then you can't go to sleep. But that's why God made melatonin. So there's that.
What else have you got?
Different kind of book, A History of the Universe in 21 Stars and Three Imposters by Giles Sparrow. And this is published by Welbeck Publishing.
You're interested in astronomy rather than sports?
I am very interested in astronomy. And especially after reading this book, I'm interested in astronomy. Do you want to hear something beautiful?
Yes.
In his introduction, Sparrow says, "In these strange times of isolation, gazing at the skies can offer the balm of a communal experience. In looking up at the same stars, we can find something to share with others near and far." I took comfort from that somehow. I thought it was really nice.
It's beautiful. I've experienced that. What did you learn from this book?
I learned how stars get their names. I learned which stars you can see with the naked eye, even if you live in the city. I learned that each star can teach us something about the birth, life, and death of our universe. For example, 61 Cygni, which is an inconspicuous double star in a constellation resembling a swan flying southward down the Milky Way, held the key to measuring distance in space. That's what he does so effectively. He takes a star and then he shows us what it has taught us about the cosmos.
If you've seen one star, you've seen them all. I mean, they look alike. Do you have a favorite star?
I totally have a favorite star. I have favorite stars, plural, now. There's Polaris, which is the laziest star in the sky. I can relate to Polaris. There's Mira, which is a pulsating star on the neck of Cetus, which is a constellation named after a sea monster. There's Alcyon and her sisters, and they are the sky's most beautiful star cluster. And then, of course, there is Sirius, the dog star, because, you know, I like animals, and because it's the brightest star in the sky, so I can actually find the darn thing.
There's no cat star?
Not that I know of. Somebody's got to get on that.
Well, what's next?
Well, I have a book that is very, very serious and very important, and I'm really excited to talk about it because it's so important. It's called Ending Parkinson's Disease. The subtitle is A Prescription for Action. And it's written by four doctors, three of whom are neurologists, and one of them is the head of the Michael J. Fox Foundation.
April is Parkinson's Awareness Month.
That it is, and we need to bring attention to the disease because brain diseases are now the world's leading source of disability. And Parkinson's is one of the most debilitating. It's also the fastest growing neurological disorder in the world. Over the past 25 years, the number of people with the condition has jumped from 3 million to over 6 million. It's more than doubled. And by 2040, it will likely have doubled again. The thing that really frustrates me about Parkinson's is that the most effective treatment for it, a medication called levodopa, is now half a century old. And yet research funding stagnates. So in short, we're failing to stop a runaway train.
It was Parkinson's disease that killed Morris Dickstein, the
Oh, really? The author. Wonderful author.
Just talking about. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So is there any particular group of people that are being affected by Parkinson's exponentially higher numbers than others?
There are actually, there are three groups. First of all, farmers. One of the pesticides that some of them use, it's called paraquat. It's considered the most toxic herbicide ever created. It kills the weeds that the pesticide Roundup can't kill. 30 countries, including China, have banned its use, but the U.S. has not. Paraquat increases the risk of Parkinson's by 150%. We're now learning that Parkinson's among farmers in the United States is absolutely exploding.
And paraquat, that was the thing that they tried to spray on marijuana. You probably before your time, Melissa, but there was a thing.
I missed this, Gary. Yeah, yes, tell me
yeah,
more.
No, they tried to kill all the marijuana that was being brought to America by spraying paraquat on it.
I had no idea. So it's been around for so long and we still haven't done anything about it. That's really frustrating. That's really frustrating. You asked about the different groups of people who are being affected by Parkinson's, and I mentioned farmers. Yeah. Another one of them is veterans. They're at a higher risk for the disease. The Vietnam War, you know, those veterans were exposed to pesticides like Agent Orange that increases the risk of Parkinson's. And many veterans, like the Marines who were stationed at Camp Lejeune, they were exposed to a degreasing agent called TCE that increases the risk of Parkinson's by 500%, 500. And about 8 million veterans have had a traumatic brain injury, which also is a known risk factor for Parkinson's disease. So for all of those reasons, our veterans are at greater risk for Parkinson's. And then the third group, people in Silicon Valley. And this was something that I did not know about at all until I read it in the book. TCE, that chemical that I mentioned previously, it's also an industrial solvent, and they use it to clean silicon wafers and electronics. And there are 21 sites in Silicon Valley, including 15 sites along a 4-mile stretch of the 101 freeway that have been contaminated with this chemical. TCE contaminates up to 30% of the groundwater in the United States, and it can form these underground plumes that then can migrate and evaporate the chemical into people's homes and workplaces. It is just dreadful stuff, and it has become the scourge of Silicon Valley.
And these authors, do they have a solution?
Yeah, thankfully they do. They say that we need to tell our elected officials that we want them to ban paraquat and TCE, and they've done something about it. They have started a red letter campaign to help people convey their wishes. You can find out more about the campaign and also more about the book at endingpd.org.
Okay, good. Now, you told me something about you have a COVID-19 book.
I kind of do. It's called Contagion: Plagues, Pandemics, and Cures from the Black Death to COVID-19 and Beyond. It's by an Indiana University professor named Dr. Richard Gunderman, and it's published by Walbeck Publishing.
And why would anybody want to read? I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic, so why would we want to read about it?
It's a fair question, but you know what? It's not just about pandemics. And this guy knows his stuff. He's an MD and a PhD. And you know what else? If you like medical history, you will find this book fascinating. Contagion explores some of the most notorious, grisly, and pernicious communicable diseases that the world has ever known. In addition to discussing their symptoms and causes and treatments and prevention, Dr. Gunderman looks at the impact on notable figures in history, everyone from soldiers to monarchs, and the extraordinary contributions of the scientists and the physicians who battled these diseases, and also the way that these diseases have influenced world history as well as human evolution.
Who are some of the people that are highlighted in this book?
There's Edward Jenner, and he is the guy who invented the first vaccine. John Snow, who was the first person to study disease scientifically. Louis Pasteur, who established the germ theory of infection. And Florence Nightingale, perhaps the most influential nurse in history. She stressed the importance of making a personal connection with patients, and that seems to me to be especially important amid a pandemic in which the sick have to be isolated completely.
Is there anything else that you learned from this book?
Yeah, don't get syphilis, really. Just don't get it.
Well, I'm going to work on that.
Good.
That's excellent advice. Well, Melissa, I know there's more to talk about, but we're just about out of time, but I want to thank you so much for dropping by and talking to us again. Will you come back again soon?
Anytime. You know it, my friend. Take good care.
You too.
Lissa Warren joins us every now and then to talk about books. She's the author of a couple of books herself, including the wonderful The Good Luck Cat: How a Cat Saved a Family. and a Family Saved a Cat, and The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity. Lissa also teaches about literature and publishing at Emerson College in Boston. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.